I made it up here without tripping. We're off to a good start. My name is not Wayne B. It's Trenton, and I'm an alcoholic. How you like me so far? It's really good to be here. I want to thank Kathy and the rest of the committee for the invitation. It's always an honor and a privilege to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, any event here. It's truly an honor and a privilege, and it's been great so far. I've tried to be here to catch the speakers as best I can. I've heard some great talks up here over the weekend. I've enjoyed it a lot right up until about right now. Some great talks. And I'm a little biased because she's my friend, but Jackie she knocked it out of the park today. And thank you to the committee for putting on an event like this. It's been great, and I know how it is. I've been on these committees, a lot of them, and I know how it is. You know, you have a few people doing a lot of work, and a lot of people taking all the credit and not doing a damn thing. That's usually how it goes. The food was great. I mean, just everything has been great. I'm just having a good time. And, you know, if you're new, welcome. Welcome to this life-saving, life-changing place. That's what happens here. Lives get saved and lives get changed. At least that's my experience. I was not only saved my life, but it gave me a life worth living. And I'm just asked to share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. In other words, that translates to, in the next 50 minutes, I'm going to get drunk, burn my life to the ground, and get sober. I mentioned Wayne. You know, Wayne was originally, he's a buddy of mine. He was originally scheduled to be here, and he had an injury and some health conditions. So, you know, I want to pray that he has a full recovery. And you did miss out. Those are some big shoes to fill. I mean, you know, he's got big feet, but I mean, those are some big shoes to fill. I spoke at an event recently, and I was there to hear Johnny H. You know, everybody's heard of Johnny H. Everybody was excited. A lot of people that don't even normally go to that meeting, they couldn't wait to hear Johnny, and Johnny didn't show. And then I got to fill in. So I keep being put in this position where, like, these, you know, everybody can't wait to hear the speaker, and then I try to take over and do something with it. Let me give you the stats real quick and get those out of the way, and I probably ought to look at my clock and see when I... I'll give you the stats real quick. My sponsor is Dan D. from Beaumont. I've got a home group, which is a Monday night inland group in Redlands. We meet on Monday nights at 7:30. If you're ever in Redlands, I don't know why you would want to be, but if you ever are, come join us. You will be welcomed, and you'll find a great meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And last but not least, on October 4th, 2006, I was given the greatest gift that a guy like me can hope for. And that's, of course, my sobriety date. By no means is that my first sobriety date, but I pray to God it's my last. I am described throughout our book. I am seldom mildly intoxicated, but usually more or less insanely drunk. That description about the Jekyll and Hyde thing, that describes me to a T. I'm a tornado roaring through the lives of others. I'm a horrible, horrible drunk. I hope I never forget the pain that I cause the people that love me the most when I take a drink. I hope I never forget that. I was born disappointed. Disappointed and needing a drink. I was born in Phoenix, Arizona in 1970. My parents' marriage was really bad at the time that I was born. They got married in like 1963, I think, and at the time, my dad looked like a young Paul Newman, James Dean-looking guy, and in 1970, when I was born, he looked like one of the Doobie Brothers. He had become a hippie, and he had this whole different life, and my parents' lives were just going in these separate directions. And I'm 2 months old. My mom went to the store one day, left me home with my dad to watch me, him and his friends, and when she got home from the store, him and his friends were around my crib, and they were laughing, and she went over to see what they were laughing about. He had put a joint in my mouth, and that little sigh I heard, that's the reaction my mom had. She didn't think it was funny. I think it's funny, man. My mom did not think that was funny. And she packed up me and my two sisters, and we moved out to California, and that was the end of their marriage. We moved into the trailer park. Are there any other trailer park kids here? Everybody's where the... I love that, man. Now I feel like I'm at home. I need to think about relocating here. I always share that, and I always ask that question. I spoke about two or three weeks ago in Beverly Hills. They didn't know what a trailer park was. Not a single hand in the crowd. Nobody. They just looked at me like, what is that? That meeting was on Rodeo. In Ridgecrest and in Yucaipa, where I'm from, that's Rodeo. But the secretary literally had a purse dog. Purse dog. Dog in her purse at this meeting. Anyway. Yeah, I grew up in the trailer park, and I was not happy at all about growing up in the trailer park. I was angry about that. I don't know. I just grew up. I always had that sense of loneliness, that deep sense of loneliness. I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. You know, I could be in a room full of people, and I felt all alone. In fact, the more people in the room, the more alone I felt. And, you know, I looked around. It seemed like everybody else had a mom and a dad, and I didn't. I just had a mom, and they had nicer shoes and nicer cars, and I was angry. I just felt robbed, you know, and a lot of shame. That trailer that I grew up in, not only was it a trailer, but it wasn't very well kept, and there weren't meals on the table at 5 o'clock, you know, like I saw on TV. And sometimes the lights would get shut off and the phone would get shut off. And, you know, I'm not talking a day or two. It would get shut off and stay off for lengths of time. And so I was angry about that. And you know, for a long time, I would tell you those stories in response to when you would ask me the question, why do you drink like you drink? Why do you do what you do? I would tell you that. I would explain that because that's why I drink. I drink because I grew up without a dad. I grew up in the trailer park. That was my reason. You know, I would give you that as my excuse. That's not why I tell you that today. I tell you that today because when I was 13 years old, I found the solution to all of it. You pour some booze on it, and all of a sudden, it doesn't matter how long it's been since your dad came for a visit or what kind of shoes you're wearing. And at 13 years old, I found the solution to everything. It was magic for me. You know, our book says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I don't disagree with that. I just think it's got to be the biggest understatement in that book, man. I am in love, y'all. I am in love with the effect produced by alcohol. In love with it. It was magic for me. And I wasn't one of those people that drank socially for a period of time and crossed over into alcoholism. I mean, from the gate, I drank like an alcoholic. And, you know, as I look back on it, there were times I was drinking things like vanilla extract, mouthwash, cough syrup, anything I can get my hands on to give me that sense of ease and comfort. I remember being like 14, 15 years old, standing in my bathroom, drinking shots of NyQuil, chasing it with Listerine. Not exactly social drinking. Most people call that desperation. I call it happy hour. So right away, my mom's concerned about my drinking. And, you know, she's coming home on a daily basis, finding me passed out on the couch at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm defending my right to drink as if I have a right to drink at 13. And I'm not going to treatment. And she had it all worked out through her insurance, and she was constantly trying to get me to go to treatment. And, you know, one of the things that happened to me is up until that first drink, I was a pretty good kid. I mean, I followed the rules. I did okay in school. I came home, and when the street lights came on, I just kind of followed the rules. I was a pretty good kid. But when I started drinking, it all changed, man. All the rules went out the window. Now I come home, and I get damn good and ready. And everything changed, and so my mom's really concerned. And, you know, I said that this wasn't my first sobriety date. My first sobriety, I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous just before my 17th birthday. That's how I get down, man. I was ready for treatment at 17, and, you know, what was going on in my life at the time, I had some girlfriends break up with me, and the only thing they said is, you're drunk every time I see you. You know, we don't like the way you drink. I like these girls, but already, you know, at that point in my life, if you get between me and a drink, then you got to go. And I'd had some run-ins with the law, you know, underage drinking, drunk in public, you know, little scrapes with the law, no big deal, but little scrapes with the law. I'd gotten kicked out of my high school for drinking Boone's Farm wine out of my locker one too many times. I got away with it a couple times, and then that last time, they just kicked me out. And I went to school with the same kids since kindergarten, and I was looking forward to, I mean, I didn't care about the education. But I, you know, the social aspect of it, I went to school with these same kids since kindergarten. I couldn't wait for that day to walk down that aisle. And like Sharon C. says, I slid it across the bar for another drink. Slid it all across the bar because, you know, kicked out of my high school. And, you know, so I was having problems. Like from day one, there was problems with my drinking. And when I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had gone out. It was a Saturday. I'd been drinking all morning. And I took my mom's car. I'd been drinking all morning. I took her car and I wrecked it. And so when I got home, I mean, I'm all the way home in the tow truck with the wrecked car in the back. I'm like, how do I get out of this? I mean, how can I get out of this? And so I went home and I said, you're right. I need help. And I went to my mom and, you know, was I sick and tired of being sick and tired? No. Did I think I was bodily and mentally different or suffering from a hopeless state of mind and body? No, I had to get the heat off. So I went home and I worked my mom. That's what I did. And I was checked into Redlands Hospital that night into an adolescent treatment program. And I was introduced to kids that were like me, that were doing the things I was doing. And, you know, in that environment, I'd only been drinking 3.5, 4 years. You put me in a hospital with kids like me, and I was able to stop pretty easy. I was able to stop. And within a few days, they put us in those white vans and hauled us off to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And although I had a lot of years of drinking ahead of me, I didn't know that at the time, but I had a lot of years of drinking ahead of me. I'm so grateful they brought me to meet you guys, man. I'm so grateful because the seed was planted. I started hearing the music in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started hearing the message. And, you know, so I'm in this hospital. It's like a 30-day treatment program. And, you know, they had a lot of suggestions there. And I know you've heard them. Get a book, get a sponsor. Work the steps, and my personal favorite, no relationships in the first year. I'm 52 years old. I'm still not listening to that nonsense. And at 17, I was like, just kill me now, man. You're going to take away the booze now, the girls? Just kill me now. So, of course, within about 30 days, I met the girl that was to become my wife. And she didn't drink. Her story with her is her dad was alcoholic, and alcoholism had destroyed her family, and she wanted nothing to do with it. And here I am, sober guy. And we were young, and we just fell in love, man. We fell crazy in love. We had the kind of relationship that you see in movies, man. We really did. It was just like just young and carefree and crazy in love, inseparable. So much so that within a couple of months, she informed me I was going to be a dad. And now I'm newly sober, new girlfriend, baby on the way. I don't know how most people come up with their dreams in life. But I know for me, I would lay in that trailer at night when I was a kid, and I would dream about someday I'm going to get up out of this trailer park. Someday I'm going to have a wife and some kids. I dreamed about being a good husband and a good dad. You know, like everything that I had as a kid, I wanted the opposite. I just assumed that whatever the opposite is, it's got to be good. And I would watch TV shows. You know, I watched The Brady Bunch or Leave It to Beaver, and they painted this picture that if you get a wife and some kids and you have a lunch pail and you go off to work every day and you know, you have a white picket fence and you're happy. And that's how I came up with my dreams in life. I didn't plan to start that at 17, but obviously my circumstances said it was time to start that. And so I told my then girlfriend, I'll work hard, we'll get married and have this baby and live happily ever after. And that was absolutely my plan. That was my plan. And, you know, by this time now I am working hard and, you know, we got married and our daughter was born and now I don't really have times for your meetings. I mean, and the problem's solved as far as I can see it. All anybody's talked about is the way I drink. Well, I don't drink anymore. The problem's solved. And so, I mean, I'll go occasionally and I always liked meetings. It's not that I didn't like the meetings. I did. So I would show up when it was convenient. And but I'm working really hard taking care of this family of mine. And so at about 13, 14 months sober, I went to work one day, just like any other day, but somewhere between work and home, I'm drunk. I never planned it. I never saw it coming, and I'm drunk. I don't understand the illness of alcoholism at the time. I think it's a drinking problem. I'm treated a drinking problem, but what I have is alcoholism. You treat drinking problems with not drinking. and what I have is alcoholism. And my alcoholism demands treatment, and what my experience has taught me is that I'll either treat it in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous or I'll ultimately treat it with a drink. And that's what I did. I took that drink, and I don't know how long I drank that time. I think it was a couple of months. I don't drink with success. I never have because within a couple of days of that drink, the job was gone. My family car is sitting in an impound lot because I got a DUI, and I'm dipping out for days at a time, doing what I do, drinking the way I drink. I never plan it like that, man. I'm stopping to have a couple of beers. I see other people doing it. I'm convinced that, you know, like I got to be home at a certain time. I'm going to do it. I'm determined. And I stop and have those couple of beers, and next thing I know, it's 3 days later. And I break those hearts one more time. And that's what I did. And like I said, I don't know how long exactly it was. I think it was a couple of months. All I know is I drank right up until I thought she was going to leave me. And when I thought she was going to leave, I ran back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the next 19 years, I would go in and out of the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, dying from alcoholism. Dying from alcoholism, and didn't even know I had it. I thought I knew what an alcoholic was. There was a guy that lived behind a liquor store by my house. He drank out of a paper sack, man. That's an alcoholic. I can see that that guy's an alcoholic. But that's not how I drink. You know, people living in the park. I mean, I saw these examples, what I thought was an alcoholic, and it didn't fit the description of me. And so I, you know, over those 19 years, it's like you would imagine. It was in and out of jails and in and out of hospitals, in and out of treatment centers. You know, get fired from a job for showing up drunk one too many times. Go get another job and get fired from it, you know, and just this, you know the story. You know the story. I mean, at one point in that, the longest I ever went without drinking was about 7 years. And I hesitate to call it sobriety because, and I always did the same thing. Like, I would get a DUI, so I'd run back to AA, and I'd go to a bunch of meetings, and I'd get sober. And now I'm feeling better, and the heat's off, and pretty soon I'm starting to back my way out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was never working with a sponsor. I was never working the steps. I was never treating my alcoholism. It was always the same pattern. And so I went this 7 years, and I didn't drink, just short of 7 years. And at the end of the 7 years, now I never saw this wife of mine drunk. Out of respect for me, and she just didn't care about drinking, she didn't drink. She would, like, occasionally have a glass of wine or a toast at a wedding or something. And at the end of this 7 years, one night she and I are going to a party. And on the way to this party, she said, "Hey, do you mind if I get some wine coolers?" And I said, "Sure, no problem." They sell these things in a four-pack, y'all. Four-pack. I never bought a four-pack of anything in my life. I didn't even know there was such a thing. Why? And anyway, we stop and get her a four-pack of wine coolers and one four-pack. Even worse, at the end of the night, there were two left in the four-pack. We put them in the trunk of the car because apparently that's where normal people put their leftover. I never had leftover booze to deal with. Put them in the trunk of the car and forgot about them. A couple weeks goes by and she and I have an argument. We're in our living room one night and have an argument just like husbands and wives sometimes have. And it got a little bit heated, a little loud, so I decided to walk outside and let things calm down. And I go out on my front porch. And while I'm out there, I remember the wine coolers in the trunk. I mean, this was just an argument with my wife. I wasn't thirsty. I hadn't been thinking about drinking. I wasn't having an obsession with nothing. I just had a passing thought. I remember the wine coolers in the trunk of the car. The next thing I know, I'm over there with my key in the trunk of that car, tipping back a wine cooler. 7 years gone, just like that. It's been my experience. No steps, no service, no sponsor, no chance. No chance. And what I didn't realize in taking that first drink that I had just fed the beast, man. I had just fed the beast. And within about 15 minutes of taking that drink, that Bartles, and if you're new, we have a term in Alcoholics Anonymous, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I think blowing 7 years on a Bartles and James wine cooler is exactly what they mean by that. But within about 15 minutes of that first drink, I was standing at that liquor store buying that big bottle of vodka, 18-pack of beer, not a four-pack, 18-pack of beer. 2 weeks from that Bartles and James wine cooler, I'm being stuffed in the back of a police car, taking that ride for DUI number 4. 2 weeks from that first drink. That's how I get down. Over the next 3 years, I drank like the only description I've ever heard that really describes how I drank was by Dr. Bob. And he called it that frightful drinking. That's how I drank for the next 3 years, that frightful drinking. Always in the past, when things would get bad, I'd come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd stop drinking. This time when things would get bad, I'd go to a meeting and then I'd stop at the liquor store on the way home. Couldn't stop. I couldn't stop, man. I was drinking against my own will. It was horrible. It was horrible. No matter how many promises I made, no matter how badly I wanted to stop, no matter all the evidence in my life saying I needed to stop, I couldn't stop, man. I couldn't stop. And at one point in there, and I can't tell you how many times I went to that wife of mine and I would make her that promise. A promise that I meant with everything in me. Today I won't do it. Today I won't take that drink. And 30 minutes later, I'm at the liquor store. Did it over and over and over. And at one point, it got really, really bad and it just got to be too much. And this wife of mine came to me and she said, "You know, it kills me to do this, but I can't live like this." And she gave me that ultimatum. And it's an ultimatum I'm sure many of you have faced in your life. And she said, "You got to make a decision. It's either the booze or me and the kids." And when I tell you this, I didn't just love this woman. I adored this woman. I respected her. I admired. I knew I married up, man. I admired her. But when she gave me that ultimatum, I stepped around her. I went into my kitchen. I got a shopping bag, threw a couple pairs of jeans in it and a toothbrush, and I headed out the door where I could drink uninterrupted. By that point in my life, booze was calling every shot, calling every shot. I didn't have a choice in the matter. Like, that's not a choice I would ever make. And I headed out the door, and when I did that, she found Al-Anon, and I thank God for it. And I know we have Al-Anon participation here. I don't know how many Al-Anons are in the room, but I got to tell you, man, I wouldn't. Thank you. Just thank you. I would not be, gets me every time. I wouldn't be standing here right now if it weren't for the example I saw right there in my own home of the 12 steps working in her life. I was getting worse, and somehow she was getting better. And it was, just like I thought I knew what alcoholism is, I thought I knew what Al-Anon was too. I was just as wrong about that. I thought Al-Anon, here's what I thought it was. I thought it was a room where they would take my wife and put her in a hot seat in the middle of the room and just tell her, leave him, leave him, leave him. And that is not my, that's what they probably should have done, but that is not my experience, because what I experienced always up until she found you guys, she would come, we would fight about my drinking. She would fight with me about my drinking. When she found Al-Anon, she stopped fighting with me. And when she would fight with me about it before, it gave me a good excuse to head out the door. Like, listen to her nagging. Of course I got to go drink. Well, now she's not fighting with me. Now she's treating me with love and compassion. Just love and compassion. She wouldn't mention my drinking. I'd get home and from a night, half the night out at the bar, and I'd find my dinner in the oven, you know? Like, she didn't say a word about it. There was my dinner. She left it in the oven for me. She didn't say a word about it. And she treated me with love and compassion. And like I said, I kept seeing her getting better. And I noticed it. This is a program of attraction. And I know something was working for her. And so she was getting better. And after a period of time, you know, I got to this place where the book talks about it. You know, I was ready to go on to the bitter end. Like, I was giving up hope. I was getting really hopeless and really desperate, getting towards the end of my drinking. And I went to my wife one day and I said, hey, you're too good for this. Why don't you just leave me? And I'll never forget her response. She looked at me with the sweetest look I've ever seen in a person's face. She looked me right in the eyes and she said, it's because I love you. And she started patting me on the center of the chest and she said, I know what's in here is good. I sure couldn't see it. I had no idea. By that point, I hated me. I had no idea what she could see in here that was good. And she said, when I married you, I meant it. And in those vows, I said, in sickness and in health. And as much, and she said, as painful as it is, to watch you continue to do this to yourself, I'll never leave you for being sick. She went on to describe what her life. She talked about the loneliness she felt. She talked about how she would lay in that bed at night and wait for that knock at the door. She talked about making dinner for four of us and only three at the table night after night. She talked about having to go to work every day to be the responsible parent, to be the mother and to do all these things and to go to work and support the family and then come home and do the homework with the kids and then make the dinner and then I'm not around to do any of it. And I talked in the beginning, I said, I'm that Jekyll and Hyde guy because when I'm sober, I do all those things. That's the thing, man. When I'm sober, I go to work every day. I pay my bills. I take good care of my family. I help around the house. I coach my kids in sports. And then I take a drink. Then I take a drink and I become everything I never wanted to be. And she described what it was like for her. But at the end, she said, but I'll never leave you for being sick. And that wasn't the very end of my drinking, but it was soon after that because I continued to drink for a while, but I couldn't drink away that look in her eyes. I couldn't drink away the words that she spoke to me. There's not enough booze out there to drink it away. I just couldn't drink it away. And I kept hearing those words. And so soon after that, I got sober. And when I started this talk, I called that date a gift. And I call it a gift because it was an absolute gift. I didn't pick that date. I think Larry T. says it best. He says his last drunk wasn't his worst one. It's just the one that drank away the debate. Because that's what happened to me. October 3rd was just another night of drinking, just like every night was. Yet I woke up on October 4th, 2006, and for the first time in my life, I conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, deep down in my soul. Like, for the first time, it's not so much that I admitted I have alcoholism. What happened, the big change that happened to me that morning was I admitted that alcoholism had me. That was the big shift. That's what I realized. Like, I don't have control over this. And I laid in that bed that morning. It was like watching a movie of my own life in slow motion backwards. I just remembered things that I had long since forgotten. Just what it felt like to wake up on a concrete floor behind bars and not even know what the charges were because I'd been in a blackout. Wake up on a concrete floor with a roll of toilet paper under my head for a pillow and not even know if I killed a family of four until I found out the charges. And, you know, another thing I remember that morning is a morning not so long before that, I had found a note slid under my bedroom door. And in the writing of a child, it said, "Daddy, please stop drinking. I'm scared. It's my baby girl, man. My baby girl." And then she said, "I'll be a good girl. I'll go to those meetings with you." Like she's taking it on, like she plays some role in why I'm drinking. Another thing I remember that morning that stood out to me was I was always very, very close to my grandmother. I adored my grandmother. When I was a kid growing up in that trailer and it wasn't clean and there weren't meals, Grandma's house was clean. There were meals on her table. So I was always at Grandma's and she never said no. And she made me feel safe. I always went to Grandma's. And that morning I remember what it felt like to see her on the other side of a thick piece of glass talking to me on a filthy county phone. I remember that heartbreak in her eyes. I woke up to face what our book describes as a hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. I was a broken man, broken in every sense of the word, just broken. And I laid there in that bed for a long time that morning, and I hope I never forget this. I laid in that bed and I begged to God that I didn't even believe in. Jackie talked about it earlier. I love the description. I related so much. A lot of the phrases she used, it's funny. Listen to her talk. I'm like, I use that phrase. Well, we stand on the shoulders of a lot of the same giants, and I love that language that we share. And, her talk about this struggle with God and spiritual belief, whatever. And I laid in that bed, and I begged something I didn't even believe in for one day sober, because it had been a long time since I'd had one day sober. And I laid there, and I begged that God for one day. There was nothing I wanted more than just one day sober. And I laid there for a long time, and I had a lot of these memories, and I thought all the way back to that first drink and how it changed my life, how it changed the course of my life. And I thought, you know, I go back to AA, and then I thought, but AA doesn't work for me. It works for Kevin. It works for Raphael. It works for these other people. It doesn't work for me. I'm that guy. I'm that guy that's never going to get it. And I thought, but it's the only success I've ever had. And then I kept having that little voice in the back of my mind saying, well, maybe if you work those steps they talk about. Maybe if you actually work with a sponsor. Maybe if you get honest. That little voice. I think I'd heard enough in your meetings over the years, just enough, that the answer was there, you know. So I decided to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And like I said, it's always been my experience, if I can get sober, come back to Alcoholics Anonymous and get sober, whatever circumstances are going on in my life, it gets better when I don't drink. It just does. And that's what was happening this time, because I begged that God for one day sober, and I didn't drink that day. And then it was another day, and then it was a week, and then it was a month. And it continued on. But this time when I was 5 months sober, that wife of mine was diagnosed with cancer. And that's not how this is supposed to go, man. I was 5 months sober when she was diagnosed, and when I was 9 months sober, she passed away. And I didn't take a drink. I'm a guy that takes a drink over every nickel and dime excuse you could ever come up with. And I walked through that experience, and I walked my kids through that experience without taking a drink. How does that happen? How does that happen? I said that my dream was always to be a good husband and a good father, and believe me, I wanted to do it a lot longer than 9 months. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be a good husband to my wife. At the time that she needed me the most, anything she wanted to eat, her shoes, her sheets were clean, her clothes were clean. I spoon-fed my wife. I took really good care of her because of you, because of you. I'm not capable. But because of you, I was able to be there and not take a drink. That's why when I get a phone call that says, Wayne can't make it, can you come up to Ridgecrest and speak on a Saturday night? The answer is yes. And you need me to stack the chairs, make the coffee? The answer is yes. There's not enough years left in my life that I could ever repay this debt. And that's just one example. That's just one of many examples. And after my wife passed away, that was like the first domino in all the dominoes of my life. It fell apart, man. The best I could do, I was grieving, and I was just, you can imagine, I was a mess. And, you know, I had somehow built up a business that had some success. And soon after that, I had to close the doors on that business, and they foreclosed on my house. And my cars, I went completely broke. Cars repossessed, I went completely broke. Because the best I could do is get up in the morning and go to the morning meeting. I come home and I get my kids' lunches ready, whatever. I take care of my kids and go back to the noon meeting. And then I come back and do some homework with them, do some stuff around the house or whatever. Go back to the 5:30 meeting. And by then I had a sponsor and I'd met Kevin. And these guys pulled me in the middle. And they did something for me that I hope we do for newcomers everywhere. Like, I didn't know I had been away from AA for so long that I didn't really know these people in my local meetings. And I would go to those meetings, and sometimes I'd just sit there and I'd stare at the floor. Sometimes I didn't hear a single word spoken. Sometimes I'd cry through the whole meeting. I was a mess. And at the end of these meetings, they would walk up to me and they'd say, "Hey, we're going to coffee, and so are you." They'd grab me by the shirt and they'd take me. They didn't say if you got time or if it's convenient. They said, "We're going to coffee, and so are you." And they wrapped me in the loving arms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm so grateful for it. And so my life just crumbled, and it was painful to watch it happen. Don't get me wrong. It was very painful to see my life fall apart like that sober. But I was sober. I was sober, and that's all I wanted. It's all I wanted was to be sober. And after about a year, you know, I'm starting to try to rebuild my life again. I got another job, and I'm making decent money. And my kids and I went and rented a place, and, you know, we're decorating it to kind of start over. And of course, I thought it would be a good time to get in a relationship. See, some of you know it was not a good time to get in a relationship. Turns out, shocking. I got to tell you guys, in that relationship, it was 6 years long. It was the sickest, most tumultuous, even by AA standards, sickest relationship you've ever seen. It was entertaining. And then we got married. And I couldn't let go, man. I couldn't let go. I was, in that 6 years, I was lied to, I was lied about, I was cheated on, and I walked on eggshells day in and day out. It was painful. It was very painful. And I'm going to meetings. I continue to go to my meetings. I continue to call my sponsor. I continue to try to be an alcoholic, you know, say yes and do what I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God I stayed in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I would go to these meetings, and I've always loved speaker meetings, and I'd sit there and I'd listen to jackasses at podiums like me with suits and ties talking about living a life beyond their wildest dreams. And I'm sitting out there with 6 or 7 years sober thinking, and I'm dying. I am in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous dying. And I couldn't let go. Another, you know, it would fall apart and I'd leave, that's it, I'm never going back. And then one more set of promises, one more set of apologies, and I'd go running back. And I had to do it as long as I had to do it. And after 6 years, the pain got to be too much, and I woke up one day and I said, I didn't get sober to feel like this. And I was finally able to let go. And it's become one of my favorite sayings. I've got posters, I've got little signs that say it, "Let go or get dragged." Because I was getting dragged pretty bad, and I was finally able to let go. And when I walked away from that relationship, our literature says that resentments are the number one offender for the alcoholic. And I believe the pages of the Big Book. I believe what it says. And when I left that relationship, I was riddled with resentments. Resentment doesn't even really describe what that was. Kevin knows. He took some of my phone calls, and they were scary. Like, I was fixing to go to jail. Some of them were bad. I couldn't sleep at night. I was, like, toxic. People would hit me up after the meeting in the parking lot and say, "Hey, how you doing?" I would tell them. Like, be prepared for a long talk. It was horrible. My buddy Pat says I put on the AA clown suit and wore it for a while. But I didn't drink, man. I didn't drink. I didn't make it look pretty, but I didn't drink. And I came here and I was honest with you. I told my sponsor what was going on. I told my buddy Kevin what was going on. And a day at a time, I walked through it. I continued to show up at my commitments, and I continued to show up, and I walked through it. And I was trying so hard to overcome these resentments because they were keeping me awake at night. I couldn't eat. I was a mess. And I write these resentments, and then I would get there, like that fourth column, you know. For lack of a better term, we always say that, "my part." I don't like that term, but for lack of a better term, "my part." Everybody kept telling me, "Look, you know, write these inventories. My sponsors give me that direction. I'm following that direction." I'd write the inventory. I'm like, what are they trying to get me to see? She's the one that cheated, not me. I didn't lie to her. She lied to me. I was trying to be a good husband, and she obviously was not trying to be a good wife. Her. I couldn't see it, man. And I would continue to write the inventories, but I couldn't see it. And I don't know how long this went on, but it went on for a long time. But I continued to take that action. You know, I continued to take that direction. And finally, I wrote one more inventory, you know, convinced it wasn't going to work. And I'm writing the inventory, and I got to that fourth column, and all of a sudden it hit me. I thought, oh, my God, I was a grieving husband. I was a grieving widower. All the red flags were there from day one. I got a can of spray paint, green spray paint, and I painted them all green and went all in, right? I was in pain. I was in fear. Like, I'm picturing my life, you know, now I'm this 36-year-old widower. I got these kids. I'm a single dad. I'm going to die alone. I got all these ideas in my brain, and she came along and made it feel better. I made decisions based on self that placed me in a position to be heard. That's all they were asking me to see in that fourth column. Not that I was a bad husband or I deserved to be treated the way I was treated or that I did something to cause it. I made decisions based on self that placed me in a position to be hurt. Oh, my God. And in that moment, this resentment that was keeping me awake at night started melting away. All of a sudden, I didn't hate her quite as much. Little by little, that resentment started going away. And I got to tell you guys, I haven't seen her now in about 8 or 9 years, whatever it's been. And don't get me wrong, I'm not looking to go meet her for lunch. But I can honestly say I have no ill feelings towards her whatsoever. And if I was to see her on the street today, I could wish her well and mean it. That day was never going to come. I was convinced that day was never going to come. And I loved what Jackie talked about this morning. That, not to keep picking on you, Jackie, but it was such a good talk. You're talking about your mom. Like, I thought that would be me. That resentment was going to kill me. And it could. It had the power to do it. And thank God I was finally able to see that. And so now that I've scared all the newcomers out of Alcoholics Anonymous, stick with us, because there's a happy ending to this story. I promise you there is. Because in the last 16 years, there are so many things that have happened in my life that I so wouldn't want to miss. And I'm one drink away from missing them all. I'm one drink away from missing them all. I'm one drink away from missing that day that I got to walk my little girl down the aisle at her wedding. I'm one drink away from missing it. Soon after my daughter got married, a few months after she got married, she came over to my house and she handed me a gift bag. In that gift bag, there was a card. And I'm reading the card. It wasn't my birthday or anything. I didn't know what this was for, but I'm free gift. I'm going to take it. You know, reading the card, and at the bottom it said, "Congratulations, Grandpa." Let me know I was going to be grandfather. And when I read that, I thought of, the first thing I thought of was my dear friend and my hero in AA was Patty O. And I'm sure a lot of you have heard her. And if you ever heard Patty O and her talk, she would always talk about being in the room when her grandson Eden was born. And when she looked into his eyes, she was looking into the eyes of God. It was beautiful the way she told that story. And when I read that card, I'm like, 9 months from now, I'm going to be looking into the eyes of God, man. Just like Patty O. And I was like pacing the floor for 9 months. And my phone rings. My daughter said, "Dad, it's time." And I beat her to the hospital. And I was the first person to hold Logan after his parents. And when they put him in my arms, I was like, here's my moment. I'm going to be looking into the eyes of God. And I look into his eyes. And I mean, don't get me wrong. His eyes are beautiful. But it's not the eyes of God. And I was like I felt guilty. I mean, it was such an amazing experience. I was so grateful. And, you know, holding my first grandson, it was great. But I was really struggling with that. You know, I'm looking into his eyes waiting for that moment. And I'm like, Patty O lied. And when I had that thought, I happened to look over at my daughter, and I just happened to look over at my daughter, and I saw the way my daughter was looking at me. She was like glowing. My daughter was like glowing. She was so content, so proud, so happy to give me that experience. And when I looked into my daughter's eyes, I was looking right square into the eyes of God. And I looked back at Logan, and I was looking into the eyes of God. And in that moment, when I had that realization, I looked up and I said, "Thank you, God, for putting me right here, right now. Thank you that my daughter didn't have to call the bar looking for her dad. Thank you that my daughter didn't have to lay in this bed. Hope that I would be there. She knew I'd be there. She knew I would be there. I'm one drink away from missing it, man." That was one of the most amazing moments of my life. I call them screenshot moments. I don't know what else to call them. They're just like those moments where we stop, like time stops. And I'm reminded, how incredibly grateful I am for this good life I get to live today. That was one of many. About 4 years ago, my son was getting married, and he came over to my house and handed me a gift bag. And I opened the gift bag, and he had a plaque made, and on this plaque there was a picture of him and I when he was small and a current picture. And in the printing and the writing on this plaque, it said, "The only thing better than having you as my dad is having you as my best man." Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be my son's best man at his wedding. I'm one drink away from missing it, man. I talk a lot about my family, and I do that because our families suffer the worst of our illness, and they deserve the very best of our recovery. And I talk about that one drink away from missing it. I don't say that just because it's some catchy little phrase I say from the podium. I say it because I am crystal clear on the fact that I am one drink away from missing everything good and decent in my life. One drink takes it. One drink takes it. My life is full of those experiences. And here's the thing, man. I am a drunk. I drink in spite of the fact that I've got four DUIs, and I go to court on that fourth DUI. I park my car around the corner because you can't let them see you driving because you got a suspended license, right? A few others have done that. I leave the courtroom, conviction fourth DUI. I drive right around the corner to the Tartan Bar because they serve really good Bloody Marys, man. That's how I drink. I drink in spite of the fact that I'm being wheeled into Loma Linda Hospital at 26 years old. ER doctor standing over me telling me, "If you don't stop drinking, you're going to soon die." 26 years old. I was admitted to the hospital. It was a liver condition, direct result of my drinking. And I was there for a few days. They got me healed up a little bit. And then I had a follow-up appointment. Like 3 days later, I go to the follow-up appointment. The doctor says, "You know, the liver is an amazing organ. If you stop drinking, it'll probably be okay. You will probably live the rest of your life and not even know you ever had this." What did I hear that doctor say? "It's not that bad yet." I was drunk by the time I got home. My wife and my kids and my grandmother, who sat by my bedside in that hospital. Come home to find me drunk one more time. After getting that kind of news, that's the way I drink. I drink, it doesn't matter. I drink in spite of the fact. Now, I am super grateful that it's not part of my story that I ever beat my wife and kids. I didn't do that. Thank God I didn't. I mean, it happens, but it's not part of my story. But we sure can terrorize a little boy, man. We sure can terrorize our kids. They can be scared. And if you get between me and a drink, that's scary for a kid. My reaction to that, my six-year-old son, one time, somebody had gotten between me and a drink, and I reacted the way I react when you get between me and that drink. And my son grabbed a phone to call 911 because he was afraid of what I was going to do. And I grabbed that phone away from him, and I prevented him from making that phone call. Terrorized him. How do you get from that moment? I can still see the look in that boy's eyes as I stand here today. I can still see it. How do you get from that place to standing at this podium? How do you get there? How do you get from there to here? And I got to tell you, if you're new, you get there by getting in the car. You get in the car. You do what Jackie said earlier. You come all the way in and sit all the way down. You take that direction of that sponsor, even though you know it's not going to work. You pray to that God that you don't believe in. You continue to do it. I pray to that God. Oftentimes, I feel like I'm talking to a pillow. It seems stupid to me. Still to this day, sometimes I feel that way. And one of my, you know, I've really struggled with that. But there are those moments where I feel it. Like I said, when I was holding my grandson, I knew I was looking into the eyes of God. I knew that day God was real. But I still struggle with it sometimes today. I have those moments. One of the gifts of being sober, a few years ago, Kevin and I and our sponsor and another sober brother got to go to Akron, Ohio and see all the sights, man. We went upstairs in Dr. Bob's house and got on our knees and said the third step prayer. God was real that day. God was real that day in that room upstairs at Dr. Bob's house. And one of my favorite guys in AA used to say, "Wherever you find God, mark that spot and visit it often." And I need to use tools like that because I struggle with it. I can't go to a church. I go to church. I've gone to church, and I see people like they're raising their hands, and they feel something that I don't feel. They get something out of it I don't get. So I got to find those experiences where it grows my faith and my belief because my very life depends on this power that I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it just amazes me how we go from where we were. How do you go from waking up on concrete floors behind bars to standing at podiums like this? Alcoholics Anonymous, man. I don't know how else to do it. I tried everything and nothing else worked for me. A couple of stories I want to share real quick. Experiences I had. I talked about my daughter had written me that note when she was little, begging me to stop drinking. Well, when I was about 7 years sober, she wrote another note. It was a letter. It was actually a nomination for a Father of the Year award for the Inland Empire. And in this letter, she talked, and it was submitted, and the people would vote based on these letters, and a lot of men were nominated for this award. And she wrote this letter, and in the letter, she didn't hide the fact that I was an alcoholic. She talked about it. She talked about what a difficult struggle I had, and how scary it was for the whole family. And she said, but then he met these people. Talked about how I came to meet you and how our whole lives changed. She said, now he puts on a suit and tie and he goes out and speaks. And he's got a sponsor and he helps other men. And he takes them to meetings and he sponsors them. And he talked about all of that in this letter. In that letter, she talked about how she watched me take care of her mother in her dying days. She talked about how I coached her in sports. Talked about how I was the one person she could always count on. In that letter, she talked about how the kind of grandfather I was. She said I was the best grandfather she could ever ask for her sons. In that letter, she described me as her hero. People voted on this thing, and it got down towards the end, and my daughter called one day, and she said, hey, Dad, you're in the top three. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. And a couple days later, she called and said, hey, you won first place. And I'm one drink away from missing it. Thank you. Once again, I'm one drink away from missing it. One drink away from missing that. I love how I have that story where I can demonstrate to you drunk Trenton, sober Trenton. The drunk letter, the sober letter. And then I have another experience. I mentioned my grandmother. You know, I talked about seeing her come to visit me at county jail. And when I was a couple years sober, my grandmother was getting to be in her 90s. She was starting to have difficulty seeing and just getting older. And so I wanted to spend as much time with her as I could. So I went and picked her up. My kids and I went and picked her up for dinner, you know, take her out to dinner. And when we got out of the car, I reached out and I helped her up on the sidewalk. I didn't want her to trip. And I didn't think anything of it. I'm just helping my grandmother up on the sidewalk. I didn't think a thing of it. And when I did that, she squeezed my hand and she looked up at me and she said, you know, whenever you're around, I feel safe. Because of you, I got to make my 94-year-old grandmother feel safe. And when she told me that, I thought, I'm going to make sure you feel safe as often as I possibly can. And it wasn't too long after that. Maybe a year later, she got, you know, sick and she started, you know, it was her time to go. And I made sure I sat by her bedside and held her hand because I thought, if I'm the person that makes her feel safe, I want to make sure she feels safe at this time. I'm so grateful. The transformation that happens in our lives as a result of coming here and doing some things that don't make sense. You know, how do you get from there to here? You show up to your Monday night home group wearing a collared shirt, your 7:30 meeting, and get there at 6:30 wearing a collared shirt. And all the way there, I'm having this conversation. I'm by myself in the car, having a conversation with my sponsor, what I'm going to tell him when I get there, that I'm a grown man and nobody tells me how to dress. Nobody tells me I have to wear a collared shirt. And why do I got to get there at 6:30? I've been doing this for years. Somebody else can start doing that work. I have all this conversation, and then I get there and I park my car and I get out with my collared shirt on. I go in and I do my commitment, and I get to stay sober another day. And I just laugh about it. I laugh about it, the conversation. I've signed up for it. I am willing. Like, I can't wear a collared shirt to go to my home group. I'm going to really fight. It's not worth it for me to do that. I think it's silly. I still think it's silly. But just like I said, half the time when I'm saying that prayer, I feel like it's going nowhere. But I do it anyway. I don't want to drink again, man. I don't want to drink again. I don't ever want to trade. I don't know what actions I've taken here. I don't know which ones I could change or give up, so I just continue to do the same actions. And Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, in our book it says we absolutely insist. We're not a glum lot. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And I got to tell you, man, in the last 16 years, we have baseball games, pool parties, concerts, I've been to Hawaii, like I said, Akron, Ohio. We go to conventions. I live the kind of life that I only sat in a bar stool and dreamed about having, man. I get to have the respect of my kids and this amazing relationship. I talked about my first grandson, Logan. Now I've got five of them, all boys. And I love every minute of it. None of them have ever seen me take a drink. None of them are scared of me. Like when I walk in the door, they run and hide. And it's not because they're scared of me. They want me to go find them. They want to play hide and seek, man. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the way I get to live my life today. And I think I'm going to wrap up a couple minutes early here. But when you're done, you're done. And just the last couple things I want to say is, and you know, I had a topic here and I kind of forgot about it. And I can just only hope that I've practiced the principles enough. And I try to practice these principles enough that they're demonstrated in my life. And I hope it came across loud and clear in my talk. I just hope it did. I apologize about that. And the last couple of things I want to say, if anybody's new, you're going to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. And it's my opinion, if you're an alcoholic and you found this place, the miracle's already happened. Don't leave 5 minutes after. And the last thing I'll share is when I was at the lowest point in my life that I'd ever been, in the grips of my alcoholism, the person that loved me more than anybody ever had or probably ever will, looked me in the eyes, told me she loved me, patted me on the center of the chest and said, "What's in here is good." I don't think that's just true for me. I think it's true for all of you. And it was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that gave me a little glimpse of what she could always see. Thank you guys so much for having me. Thank you.